Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Documentary filmmaker Morgan Neville has a distinct knack for illuminating the lives of celebrities and public figures you thought you knew, but presenting them in a new light. Last year, he turned his lens on the lives and careers of two very different icons, actor and director Orson Welles and children's television star Mr. Rogers. His film, The Love Me When I'm Dead, tells the story of the legendary Hollywood exile, we're talking Orson Welles now, attempting to make a searing takedown of a traditional Hollywood called The Other Side of the Wind. Now, in Won't You Be My Neighbor, which is one widespread acclaim, Will dives into the lives and careers of Mr. Rogers, who may have been more revolutionary than those cardigan sweaters would have us believe. Let's take a listen to Elizabeth Siemens, who played Mrs. McFeely on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, tells why Fred Rogers was radical for his time.
For him to say that feelings of a young child are every bit as powerful as our adult feelings. I guess he was radical. I know everyone says that, but he was radical.
I've always felt that I didn't need to put on a funny hat or jump through the hoop to have a relationship with a child.
Won't You Be My Neighbor is set to premiere on HBO on February 9th, and The Love Me When I'm Dead is available to stream now on Netflix. And Morgan's in studio. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. I have so many questions about the filmmaking process and about the subjects. With both of these films coming out this year, what order did you make these in? They're so different.
You don't always get to control these things.
Mm-hmm.
The Orson Welles film was percolating for years. I thought that film was going to happen first and the Mr. Rogers film second, and it ended up flipping around.
Oh, that's interesting.
And because part of it is I couldn't get my hands on the Orson Welles footage because it was locked away in a vault in Paris for decades.
Okay, that's a conversation.
We'll yeah, that's a whole rabbit hole to go down. But the Mr. Rogers film was just a film that it came to me really because somebody sent me, you know, those viral videos that go around of Mr. Rogers in the Senate, and somebody, there was one of him giving a speech, and I watched it in bed one night, and it just struck me, like, where is this voice in our culture? And I ended up going down this rabbit hole of Mr. Rogers' commencement addresses and watching them till like 2 a.m. And I basically, by the end of that, just felt like I have to make a documentary about him. Like, I didn't realize how radical he was. I mean, you played that
mm-hmm.
clip. I mean, the working title of the film was The Radical Mr. Rogers. And he was radical in so many different ways. I mean, it's so, I mean, I grew up loving the show, like a lot of people that grew up with him. We didn't realize what was really happening in the show, what he was really doing. We just internalized it all.
Mm-hmm.
So when I really understood what would the depth that was going on and the messages he was delivering, but also the kind of message in today's day and age where somebody's advocating for, I mean, kindness and civility, these things sound almost kind of too cutesy, you know,
mm-hmm.
but I think we defy defending kindness at our own peril, you know, that
yeah.
there's no kindness lobby in Washington, D.C., though there should be. There's nobody advocating for the neighborhood, for how we treat each other. And in fact, so much of our culture has been built up now, our politics and our economics, our media, oftentimes around dividing us and making us fear one another. And that's the exact opposite message of what Fred was doing.
Well, it makes you realize when you think about kindness, kindness is different than niceness because kindness is active.
It is. I mean,
you have to really be doing something to be kind. And sometimes it can be something that firing someone can be the kindest thing you do for them.
Absolutely. And one of my favorite Fred Rogers quotes is, love is an active noun like struggle. You have to work towards it. And I think that's so true. I mean, kindness and love are
mm-hmm.
not passive, bland ideas. I mean, they are things you have to work at and you have to invest in. And the thing, the kind of the greatest kind of revelation to me about Fred Rogers as a person was culturally, he's seen as this kind of milquetoast guy in a cardigan who's quintessentially two-dimensional. And in fact, he was like, he had an iron will And he worked so hard. I mean, he was such a tough person in that way because he was fighting for love and kindness. And I don't think anybody ever understood how much will and effort went into what he did.
Had someone attempted to make a documentary about him before?
There's never really been a documentary about him.
That's so interesting that someone hadn't...
Well, and I think the estate had always kind of kept it at arm's length. And
is that about protecting,
protecting
the image and the legacy?
Yeah, and just, and basically when I then went to go pitch Joanne Rogers, the widow, and the company and everybody else, my pitch was, I want to make a film about ideas. And if you trust me to do this, you have to trust me completely because you can't control anything. And they thought about it and they came back to me and said, yes, we trust you and we'll do it. And in fact, Joanne Rogers, her parting words of wisdom to me when I went off to make the film were, don't make Fred into a saint. And I thought that was music to my ears, because I think for Joanne to make Fred Rogers into a saint, and he's somebody who's very easy to turn into a saint, but to make him into a saint keeps him two-dimensional. You know, it doesn't acknowledge the human struggle he put in to actually doing all these good works. And it doesn't make us have to measure up to him because he would exist on the saintly plane. You know, so I think to understand that it was hard work to do these things, it seemed simple, but oftentimes the simplest things are the hardest to do and to make them seem simple. And so with that advice, we just went off and made the film. And, when we were done with the film, I went back and showed it to Joanne. And, her two comments to me, which I thought were funny, were the first one she said was, that was so wonderful, I didn't even cry once. And since it's a movie that's known for making people cry, I thought she was the one person for whom I think that was actually a good review.
Yeah.
Because it actually, it gave her this joy to both kind of see Fred and see that we got Fred. And the other thing she said was that Fred would have loved this film, because I think it understood the complexity of what he was trying to do and the message.
We're talking to Morgan Neville. He's the director of Won't You Be My Neighbor, about Mr. Rogers. I want to follow up on the idea that you didn't present him as a saint, because one of the reviews, which I think was I love A.O. Scott at the New York Times.
Sure.
He kind of zeroes right in. He said it had intellectual rigor, the film.
Yes.
When it could have just been a whole sentimental walk down a sentimental lane. So what were some of the decisions you made in the filmmaking and in the editing?
Sure.
That
I mean,
lived
it's,
up to that.
It's a film that begs for nostalgia, and I fought against that. I mean, I'm not a fan of nostalgia because it's like the fast food of emotions. Like, it doesn't ask anything of you to be nostalgic. Nostalgia is it means going home. I mean, it's a reactive, regressive idea, and I wanted this to be a progressive film. Mm. I wanted it to be about ideas that were relevant to today. It's not about going back. If you watched the show as a kid, no doubt you feel a wave of nostalgia just from seeing the characters and the puppets, and for me making it, things coming back to me I hadn't thought about in a long time. But, you know, deciding to include scenes like the protests at his funeral, I mean, that is the anti-nostalgia scene, you know, that's a scene, for instance, that would never be in a normal biography of Fred Rogers, but was really about the war of ideas that he was engaged in. Yeah, I mean, the real tension in the film and the real tension in his life was, I do these good works and I spread these good ideas in the world, but is the world listening? Does the world care? And throughout his life, it seems like the world just gets worse and worse, even though he tries harder and harder. And I feel like that's the legacy and the moment we're still living in now, with this great discrepancy between, you know, good ideas and a world that doesn't necessarily listen.
Were you concerned at all, in terms of the world not listening, that we're too cynical, that the audience out there might be too cynical to take in a Fred Rogers
story? Yes. And in fact, when I told people I was making a Fred Rogers documentary, there were a few people that had that kind of like, oh, really? Mr. Rogers? We can do Romper Room next? You know, like, kind of...
no shade, you know, on Romper Room.
No, you know. But, yeah, like, can you do... Is there intellectual rigor? Mm-hmm. Is there depth there? And, you know, I came to understand that... that not only was there great depth, but that Fred Rogers' superpower was sincerity. I mean, he was unbelievably sincere, and we live in such cynical times. The question I didn't know is, does that sincerity cut through to an audience today? And the thing is, it does. Mm-hmm. I mean, that Fred, he was so sincere and so direct that he's going to find your emotional bullseye no matter how many layers of, you know, cynicism you have around you. And in a way, that's what kids do. I mean, kids, he spoke like a child in the best possible way.
They go right for it.
The kids will tell you what they're thinking. They'll tell you what they're afraid of. They'll ask what they want to know. And as we get older, we mask our intentions. We hide our emotions. Mm-hmm. Fred never did that. Fred was always as direct as a child. And you come to understand the strength of that. You see him do it in the Senate testimony. You see him do it on talk shows. You see him melt people just by being as direct and sincere as possible.
And there's also this really moving to this point in this in the film when they discuss Bobby Kennedy's assassination. Yeah. And is it Tiger Rag that asks?
It's Daniel Tiger.
Daniel Tiger.
Yeah, Lady Aberlin.
Tiger Rag was my sister's toy. Oh. Looked an awful lot like Daniel Tiger. That's funny. Family slip. Daniel Tiger asks, what's an assassination?
I mean, that clip was kind of the key for me in the beginning, because I'd read about this episode he had done about the Kennedy assassination. And in fact, what had happened was Kennedy was killed on a Wednesday night, and his funeral was televised on Saturday nationally, Saturday day. And Fred said, I have to put something on television because every child in America is going to be home and watching this, and they're not going to understand what happened, and I need to help explain it. So he quickly threw this together, and it aired Friday night, the night before the televised funeral. It aired one time. It was never seen again. Mm-hmm. So when I began my research and I went to Pittsburgh, the first thing I wanted to see was this special. This is actually even before I decided to make the film. It's when I was thinking about making the film. And when I watched that special, I didn't know exactly what it was going to be, but any doubt I had that there was a film and that there was tension and there was dimension and that everything I wanted in a film was somehow in that episode. You know, and I knew I could find a film just by watching that episode because it was remarkable, you know, and it was the first year he had done a show and he's nervous, but you see him understanding his role in the culture and his role for children, too, in a way that nobody else is looking at for children.
Talking to Morgan Neville about his film, Won't You Be My Neighbor, about Fred Rogers. It was interesting to watch it because we're the same vintage. So we grew up on Fred Rogers. And yeah. It's hard to think of life before Fred Rogers as a kid. But there was. And it's interesting that he says, I see this thing called television and I sense its power.
Yes.
Which I found very interesting that he realized it was power. I never thought of Mr. Rogers and power necessarily in the same sentence.
Well, yeah, I mean, another thing he said was, I went into television because I hated it so. I mean, he understood that this was a huge tool that was going to change society. I mean, he actually came along. I mean, the timing of his life also was perfect in terms of coming of age right when television came of age. And, you know, he was going to go directly into the ministry. And when he discovered television, he altered his entire life. You know, we don't talk about it in the film, but he actually moved to New York for a couple of years and worked originally kind of as a stagehand at NBC at Rockefeller Center.
Oh, to learn TV?
To learn TV.
Oh, that's interesting, yeah.
And he worked on shows like your Show of Shows and mm-hmm. Gabby Hayes and Kate Smith Hour and kind of learned the mechanics of television and then went back to Pittsburgh and helped to be one of the first employees at the first public television station in the country, which was WQED in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And so he understood what it could do before most people did. And in fact, he understood particularly in terms of how it would affect children, that there would be generations of kids being raised by this box in our living rooms and what that would mean. nobody was thinking about those things. All people thought about then, and to some extent now, in terms of children's television, was how to sell sugar and toys. Yeah. You know? And he understood that as a somebody of faith and somebody who understood the power of what happens in one's childhood, that was going to be crucial.
It's interesting also the texture of seeing his wife and his kids. His son's got that deep voice. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. It made me, I mean, as an adult, I know Fred Rogers had a family, but as a kid, it's like, no, he doesn't. He lives in that room with the train. Tell me a little bit about the family and, you know, how they feel about Fred Rogers and how they feel about Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, the sons had never done an interview before. And I felt like, I mean, my sense was that they had shared their father with the world their entire life. So for example, you know, Fred always spoke directly to a child on the other side of that lens. And he wanted kids to believe that they had a real relationship with him. You know, he got more letters than anybody in America because kids
sure
believed that, you know, he was their friend. So whenever he was in public, any child that saw him, of course, would go up to him. And Fred, of course, would acknowledge that relationship as a real pre-existing relationship. That's got to be really hard if that's your dad.
Yeah.
You know, that you're really, literally sharing your father in every moment. And Fred was very good about kind of having family time. He had dinner at home every night. And their kids loved their dad. They loved Fred. Mr. Rogers was something way more complicated because that was something that belonged not to them, but to the rest of the world. And one other thing Joanne actually said to me after I first showed her the film was that this is so good for the boys because it was a chance for them to reclaim something of their father for themselves. And they've been great with the film.
Won't You Be My Neighbor was set to premiere on HBO on February 9th. So you want to check it out? Do you want to spend a couple minutes?
Sure.
On the Love Me When I'm Dead? You can watch it on Netflix now. You said at the top of the interview it was percolating for a long time, but then all the footage was locked up in Paris.
Yes.
What happened?
Well, it's a very long story. I mean, it's a story that goes back decades, and I tell part of the story in the film, mm-hmm. but, you know, there's stories within stories. Basically, Orson was making his last great movie, The Other Side of the Wind, and I tell the story of him making this movie in the documentary, but the chaos that reigned in the making of the film reigned in the decades since he passed away and in trying to liberate the film, and it was the most famous film never finished mm-hmm. until now. So years ago, when I had the idea for the film after reading Josh Karp's book, I went to them and I said, look, if you can ever get the footage, I want to make a documentary. And they said, that's great. And you're in luck because we're just about to close a deal. We'll have the footage in weeks. We can be in production, you know, in 2 months and we'll be done. And that went on for years.
So, 2 weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
Fast forward so, 2 years later. That's funny.
So I had my own little dose of the chaos that Orson dealt with, and that Orson, in fact, sometimes kind of manufactured.
Of course.
You know, Orson loved chaos in a way. You know, he said the job of the director is to preside over accidents. And the thing was, if there were no accidents happening, he would make them happen because then he could preside over them. He liked the chaos because he thought that's when the truly original things are discovered. And that's great for him. It's hard for a lot of other people.
What did you discover about Orson Welles as you, because you're a filmmaker, you're a cinephile, you know.
Yes.
What did you find out that you thought, like, that's a little mind-blowing?
But this is a whole chapter of his life that hasn't ever really been told. And the thing is, in the popular conception, I mean, still to this day, the popular conception of Orson at the end of his life was he was doing Parmesan wine commercials and he was on talk shows and he was kind of a has-been overweight actor. I remember the Parmesan commercials. I remember him in the Muppet movie. You know, I remember him doing the voice in the Transformers animated cartoon, his last movie performance, in fact. You know, what the reality is that Orson was working incredibly hard to make edgy, independent, avant-garde movies throughout all of those years. And he was taking all the money he was making from these acting roles and performances and putting them into his movies. He was never able to finish the movie, so we never heard that part of the story.
Hmm.
So I really wanted people to understand that Orson, in fact, never grew complacent. I mean, in fact, as he grew old, he grew more daring. I mean, somebody said about him, he was a professional who became an amateur. And they meant that as a compliment. And this idea of keeping your innocence and your daring when you're old is incredibly difficult. You know, most people go the other way. And I think Orson was doing his most, most daring, most avant-garde work at the end of his life. And so I just wanted to celebrate that. And I, as a filmmaker, I find that hugely inspiring, you know, to see the chances he was taking.
And you took some interest. You made some interesting choices in the way you made this documentary. So
well, I felt if you don't make big choices with an Orson Welles film, then when are you going to do it?
When are you going to do it? The name of the film is The Love Me When I'm Dead. It's available to stream now on Netflix. And Won't You Be My Neighbor will premiere on HBO on February 9th, both directed by my guest, Morgan Neville. You're on the award show circuit. We'll probably see your face come Oscar time.
Knock wood.
Knock wood. Morgan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we'll talk about the films nominated for this year's Cinema Eye Documentary Awards, an annual ceremony that celebrates the best in nonfiction filmmaking. Yeah, Won't You Be My Neighbor? It's one of the nominees. We're talking to its founding director, AJ Snack, after a quick break. This is All of It. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. 2018 was an incredible year for documentary filmmaking, from the jaw-dropping revelations about triplets separated at birth to the nail-biting antics of a rock climber attempting to scale El Capitan. Documentaries of all kinds dominated dinner table conversations and raked it in at the box office like never before. Now documentarians and their subjects will be receiving awards at the 12th annual Cinema Eye Honors, a ceremony designed to honor not only the best documentary films, but everybody who worked behind the camera to make that magic happen. Founded in 2007 by documentarian AJ Snack, the awards will be presented at the Museum of Moving Image tomorrow night. And AJ is with us now. It's funny to see you come in and give Morgan a hug. I guess you guys know each other from, from way back.
I think his office and my house is like a mile apart in Los Angeles.
So. Oh, that's so interesting. So the great thing about these awards, they don't just honor directors, but also cinematographers and editors. Why is it important to honor and include all those folks, especially with documentary filmmaking?
Well, that was like a real key to why we wanted to do it in the first place. I'm a director, but you see, you know, when you do your premiere, like you can bring your whole team with you. As you kind of go along the process, it's much more about the director only.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not how you make films. I mean, you have a team that you rely on, your producers, your cinematographers, certainly your editors in documentary, composers, and sometimes graphic designers and animators, and your subjects. You couldn't make the films without your subjects. So Cinema Eye really was about how do we find a way to celebrate the entire team and recognize the work that they do, when a lot of times documentary is just one award in a larger award show. It's like best documentary and we'll take 5 minutes to do it.
Right.
It's a chance to like really get everybody back together at the end of a year like this one, which has been, as you mentioned, so tremendous.
What do you think's going on that this year was so big?
Well, I mean, I just love that, you know, we were told as documentary filmmakers for a while that, you know, no one wanted to see our films in theaters anymore. Like, you know, people only wanted to watch them on TV. That's where, you know, they would stream them or maybe even on their phones. And the fact that this year has been one of the biggest, if not in some ways the biggest year for documentaries in theaters is incredibly exciting. And the fact that the films that have been doing so well at the theaters, as you mentioned with Morgan,
mm-hmm.
they're not the films that have done well in the past. They're not overtly political. They're not nature films. They're not celebrity bios. And I think that speaks a lot to the health of documentary and that people really want to watch them. Not just on streaming, not just in theaters, mm-hmm. on airplanes, everywhere.
And you decided to have an audience choice category.
Yeah.
Why did you do that?
You know, just basically in the beginning, it was to say that there are some films that really just resonate so well with audiences, and to give, you know, a larger group of people who watch films the opportunity to vote. This year, more than 22,000 people voted for our Audience Choice Prize. And that's exciting. It's exciting to see them engaged with the form and with the films.
It's also interesting. There's been a lot of experimentation in documentary. It's not just sitting, you know, talking headshot, cut to B-roll, talking headshot, cut to B-roll. Tell us a little bit about some of the people who went out on a limb a little bit creatively this year.
Well, certainly Ramel Ross in his film Hail County is both cinematic and intimate. It's, you know, some people talk about it as being like a new kind of cinematic language in terms of how he put together and edited that film. I think Bing Liu's Minding the Gap is certainly one of the most acclaimed films of the year. He takes a very personal story and turns it into something that is both cinematic and like, I think audiences really respond to the stories of these three young men and their families. You know, you mentioned Free Solo also. I think that what's interesting about a lot of the films this year is the way in which they acknowledge the filmmaking process in the films themselves. I mean, Free Solo spends a great deal of time talking about what are the ethics of them actually making that film. Of Fathers and Sons, which is a tremendous film by Talal Durki.
He came in, we had him in,
Yeah, and unfortunately he is not able to come back for the ceremony he was supposed to present tomorrow night, but because of his visa not being approved, which may be because of the government shutdown, he is not going to be able to return to the United States, which is really terrible. But his film is you know, where he lived amongst ISIS and was able to film in Syria. That also really does reflect quite openly the documentary filmmaking process.
His fear, his embedding himself with these radical people who are doing all kinds of things that are against what he believes in on his homeland. It was really, it's harrowing.
Yeah, no, it's an extraordinary film.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a lot of others. I think the shortlist this year is really interesting in terms of the fact that there are four international films: The Distant Barking of Dogs, which is a tremendous verite portrait of a family in the Ukraine; Communion, which is a beautiful Romanian film; and The Silence of Others. You know, these four films, along with all these other American titles that have been so successful, it's a great year for documentary. And I think we're excited at CinemaEye to celebrate those films and also a bunch of others that the Academy might have missed.
Talking to AJ Snack, filmmaker and founder of CinemaEye Honors. The awards will be presented tomorrow at the Museum of Moving Image in Queens. I think it's interesting when you have the filmmaker is maybe as interesting as the film. I'm thinking of Rashida Jones making the film about her dad, Quincy Jones.
Yeah.
Does that happen often where the filmmaker almost becomes part of the story aside from, you know, the political ones?
You know, Rashida, I felt like
she's so smart.
Yeah, yeah. She and Al just did such a great job on that film. I mean, talk about like what a huge life to try to put into a movie, and the way in which they like were able to tell his story and not be like, you know, it didn't feel like it was a daughter with a love story to her dad. It was like, no, warts and all, this is what's great about him, and these are the times when he's kind of a pain in the butt, you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was great. I think there's a lot of That is a thread of documentary where the filmmaker is in the film somehow, and I think we saw that a lot more this year in various ways. And maybe that's another reason why people felt like more connected to the films.
Because the filmmakers were conduits as well, not just the filmmakers.
Exactly.
You're having a legacy award. Oh, the Great Eyes and the Prize.
Yeah.
Tell me about the selection.
Well, a couple of things. We introduced an award this year for Outstanding Nonfiction Series, which anyone who's been streaming on Netflix or elsewhere knows that, you know, from Making a Murderer on, it's, you know, everybody wants to watch Wild Wild Country and Evil Genius and all of these bingeable series. You know, there is a legacy going back to the great PBS films, American Family, of course, and Eyes on the Prize, a film that really resonated with me and with a bunch of people on our executive committee. I think one of the great things about recognizing Eyes on the Prize this year is the Black Side method behind how Eyes on the Prize was made. Henry Hampton mandated that each episode should be helmed by two people, one African-American, one Caucasian, one woman, one man, people who had not necessarily worked together before, but they would be in charge of each of the episodes. And I think that thoughtfulness about diversity and what the civil rights story was, that it wasn't just a story for African-Americans, that it was a story about America, and the way in which this year's filmmakers are so diverse. I mean, we have the most diverse nominees in CinemaEye history, which I think speaks to the fact that, you know, this is a we can look at something like Eyes on the Prize and the way in which they had diversity behind the camera and see that also reflected today in what's happening in documentary.
It's interesting. That looks at the past, the awards about the present. If you had to sort of describe what you think the next thing is in documentary filmmaking, what do you think the next evolution is?
It's hard to say, other than the fact that, you know, I think going back to saying that we've shown that people want to see it in all different kinds of ways. I think the short form is still is not yet been fully explored to its ultimate degree. There are a lot of outlets that are doing really interesting things in short form. But I think that short form series, short films that are not, you know, half hour or longer, but are, you know, 8 minutes or 9 minutes, I think that will continue to be an exciting place for filmmakers to experiment and do things that haven't been done previously. So that's an area I always look for like what's exciting in terms of what's coming.
Okay, in the last minute, tell me what you're working on. What's your next project after this? I know this is big, but...
Well, yeah, no, I just finished doing a bunch of... I've been following American politics for the last, like, 10 years.
Yeah,
So that was pretty... That's pretty overwhelming. I don't know.
Need a rest?
Yeah, kind of good to be off that. But I just did an art installation, actually, which was a new way of doing documentary, a multi-screen art installation at the Eden Hotel in Washington, D.C., which just opened. And I'm just gearing up to do a new documentary feature that I'm not allowed to speak about.
All right. Well, when it happens, will you come back and talk to us about it?
I certainly will.
Excellent. AJ Snack, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
The four final days of Cinema Eye Week are taking place in New York City with a series of celebratory events bringing the year's most accomplished filmmakers. The Cinema Eye Awards will be presented at the Museum of Moving Image in Queens on Thursday, January 10th. Don't go away. I'll be right back after a quick break with a conversation and performance by the folk trio Lula Wiles. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. At the end of our show yesterday, folk trio Lula Wiles somehow managed to fit an electric guitar, acoustic guitar, a violin, and an upright bass in this little studio. Watching them hustle in and out with all those instruments and an amp was pretty hilarious, and I wish you guys could have seen it. Then they told us about their songwriting process and the fateful summer they met at band camp and performed their song, Love Gone Wrong. But because everything took a little while to set up, we didn't get a chance to cover all the ground we wanted to. So Issa Burke, Ellie Buckland, and Molly Obamaswin agreed to hang out a little bit longer to chat and perform one more song. Here's the second half of yesterday's conversation with Lula Wiles. So did you guys all go to Berklee School of Music, is that right?
For varying lengths of time and degrees of success. So I'll just, you know, fully...
Disclose
that I dropped out mid-semester while we were recording our first record like 3 years ago, something like that.
Yeah.
I had had enough, and I loved being in the band and recording, and at the time, I was like, wait, this is what I want to do, because we were in the studio all the time, and I'm like, I'm not finishing. So anyway.
And I was there for a year. This is Molly speaking. I was there for a year and then transferred to Dartmouth College.
Mm-hmm. And I, Issa, have a degree in violin performance and songwriting.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's a lot of information in there.
Yeah,
for
yeah. Yes. I think it says a lot about the dynamic within the band, maybe. Yeah.
I mean, Berklee, the fact that you all got into Berklee is extraordinary. I mean, that's an amazing, amazing accomplishment. For you, what was it for you, Issa, that made you go all the way through to the end? And what do you think that you learned there that you bring to this project, to Lula Wiles?
I like to finish what I start. Mm-hmm. Not to say that Ellie doesn't. No. I wanted the piece of paper, even though it doesn't mean that much in the music industry. Like, you know, our booking agent doesn't care that I have a degree. I learned a lot there, and I think we all can say that we did. I spent a lot of time in the songwriting program, and I just learned to think about songwriting in ways that I never had occurred to me before. It's kind of like, you know, we got to study with really amazing people like Bonnie Hayes, who has written some hits for Bonnie Raitt. She wrote that Bonnie Raitt song, Love Letter, if you know that song.
Oh, great song.
Yeah. So she taught me and Ellie how to write songs. Mm-hmm. But it's really cool. It's like someone showing you like the inside of a clock. You're like, oh, that, like, that's how that works. That's what people are often thinking about when you write a song. And so that's really cool. And then the other thing that was a big part of my experience at Berklee was the American Roots Music Program. There's a really great program dedicated to all different kinds of traditional music of America and beyond. So got a chance to study with a lot of really great fiddle players, like Bruce Molsky, who's kind of a Appalachian fiddle hero of mine. So yeah, there's so much that I learned there. I think what I learned at Berklee was how to think about music. That's if
and
I can sum it up.
Bring your old time jams to the band. That is for sure.
Yeah.
Now, Molly, I have to ask you. You went to Dartmouth. Did you stay out and graduate at all?
I did. I have a degree in government and comparative literature from Dartmouth.
What year?
This last year, 2018.
My niece just graduated 2012. Nice. My sister was third class of women at Dartmouth.
Wow.
Can you imagine that?
Wow. Poor her.
She's tough. She's tough.
She must be.
She's tough. But that's sort of interesting because, I mean, Dartmouth still is sort of a small C conservative place.
Oh,
and here
yes.
you are as yes. this musician coming in. What was that transition like for you? And then how'd you come on back to your music friends?
Oh, my God. The transition was miserable. I don't know. I think I got
it's
in a
like
lot of
simultaneous too.
Yes. Yeah, totally. It happened like the band started at the end of my year at Berklee. And I did two semesters, right? The regular year at Berklee. And then I also did a summer semester, and that summer is when the band started. So I missed like most of the summer semester, although I did pass overall, at Berklee.
We were touring.
Yeah. And then went to Dartmouth like 2 weeks later. And a lot of my professors at Dartmouth were really confused about why I was like leaving for a week and a half and not telling them. Whereas at Berklee, they support you leaving for tour kind of quietly.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, totally. And Molly, I will just say, Molly worked her butt off to keep, keep working with the band while she was finishing school. Because Ellie and I both finished school 2 years before Molly did. So we were kind of in limbo for 2 years where Ellie and I were like holding things down on the business end. And Molly was like writing papers in the back of the tour van, like just working like a maniac. And so we made it work.
We did.
Ellie, when did you realize that this thing called Lula Wiles was going to work? That you guys could actually do this and
question.
Tour and make records? And
I think... Oh, it's so interesting. Well, Issa and I had been playing as a duo around Boston for about a year. And since we knew Molly from before, and we've all been like old friends, like teenage friends, when Molly came to Berklee, we simultaneously got hired to play this like bluegrass festival, and we were feeling maybe a little bit insecure. We're like, oh, we need a bass player for this bluegrass festival.
Yeah.
Like,
you can't
oh,
play
great.
Bluegrass without a bass
yeah,
player.
Like, yeah, cut. And so Molly, we invited Molly to play with us, and Molly wasn't officially in the band for a few months, and then I think what solidified it is I can't think of a specific moment, but the feeling of having three people who were all really, really excited to play together, and we really get along. We're all like very close friends, and the friendship that we have and the love we have for each other as just like individuals is a big part of, I think, why our band works. And there's a lot of trust there, I think. And so I really think that it was just like, over time we developed into a situation, into a band where we could really lean on each other. And, you know, we were doing all our own business and booking and like really working so hard to play as much music as we could and tour as much as we could. And
I think we just, overall just like showed ourselves that it could work.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. And it was a really, I don't recall like one moment where we realized it just kind of, as things have progressed, we were like, oh, wow, we're playing at this festival. Okay. Oh, wow, we made an album. Oh, wow, we made another album. Oh, wow, we have record labels interested in our second album. Like, it just sort of has been like
a series of surprises.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. We really, grew. And then I think, too, bottom line is we're all really dedicated to the band and the music.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're talking to Issa Burke, Ellie Buckland, and Molly Obomsawin.
Obomsawin.
Obomsawin? I'm so close. Obomsawin. They make up Lula Wiles. When you decided to make the second record, what is it you wanted to accomplish on this? And what had you learned from your first?
Oh, man, great question.
Well, the first album, I think, of many bands, not all, but many,
is usually a collection of songs that have existed for a long time, just like all of the songs you've written that you still think are good from when you were 16 on, mm-hmm. you know? And that was definitely the case for us. We're like, okay, well, this is what we have. So, and then they were all original songs on the first album. But for the second album, obviously, we had a lot more, a lot shorter of a time in between albums mm-hmm. than like
our whole lives.
Yeah, our whole lives.
Yeah, it's like before the music one. Industry cliche, like you have your whole life to write your first album and 9 months to write your second album.
And we did, we realized as I was like turning a new year in school that we had to write and record an album like really soon, basically, or else we wouldn't be able to until after I graduated. So we had, I think the pressure cooker of that situation yeah. made us put a lot of thought, conscious thought, into recording this album. Mm-hmm. And I think the songwriting process being within sort of a 6 month period also helped us to write an album that was cohesive
yeah.
Thematically. You guys want to talk about
it's that? It's true. Yeah. And I agree with Molly. And I think that the fact that we were writing it within a 6 month period, I said this earlier today, I think it created a sense of urgency. And at the time, in the world, like politically and culturally, there was so much going on that I
and
think
still is,
still is. But
it never ends.
Yeah, a lot of the content of a lot of our songs and the thoughts behind it were things that we were like deeply thinking about. And so I think our intention was to make an intentional record, mm-hmm. And then musically too. I think we wanted the growth in our songs and the growth of our band and the fact that we were thinking about these like heavy and complex topics, I think we wanted the arrangements and the music to reflect that. Mm-hmm. So we went into the studio wanting to make something really, really real mm-hmm. And have an organic sound. We recorded most of it live all together in the same room. You know, not many overdubs and...
Yeah. And I think that also kind of reflects, you know, how like we've all grown as musicians. When we made the first album, it was kind of our first time. Like, I think I'd done like some background singing mm-hmm. before, but it was our first real like beginning to end studio experience. And so then by the time it came time to make the second album, we had the experience of making the first one. Plus we've all done some more recording with other artists too. So we had a clearer sense of like, okay, we feel confident that we are able to pull this off playing everything in the same room. Cause that really limits your ability to edit everything. Right. I think we had a lot more of a clear vision going into the second record, as opposed to the first one. It was just like, well, here's what we have. Let's like see what comes out.
Yeah, and we definitely learned from our mistakes in the first record, or like learned from that experience to yeah. bring it to the second. Yeah.
We're going to get you to play one more song, but I have to ask a question. Mm-hmm. Lula Wiles. Mm-hmm. I want to know three names you rejected before you came up on Lula Wiles.
Oh, my God.
And then explain to folks what Lula Wiles is.
Okay.
Three rejected names.
Rejected.
Well, one rejected name was Ellie Buckland, Issa Burke with Molly Obamsawin. That was just a terrible band name.
But we couldn't come up with a band name for a long time, so we were doing that, which was terrible. I mean,
What were some of the first things? We put it out as a contest to our fans
yeah.
because we couldn't think of anything. Do you remember any of them?
Well, so we could tell the Wiles story. Yeah. So initially we were called the Wiles for a brief moment. And then
based off of the idea of feminine Wiles.
Yeah. I used to always joke about us using our feminine Wiles on people. So I think Molly was the one who suggested the Wiles. But then we got some increasingly unhinged and profane emails from a guy who had a band called the Wiles.
Let's move on from that name, everybody.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, like he had it first. Like he was in the right. He just expressed himself
in the wrong.
Yes. So we let him have the name. And then my dad actually came up with Lula Wiles, which is based on the title of an old Carter family song. They have a song called Lula Walls. And we wanted something that kept Wiles in the name. And this character of Lula Wiles in the song is, she's quite wily. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's where Lula Wiles came from. But yeah, there were people suggested some really funny yeah. names.
But we're glad about Lula Wiles.
I like it.
Yeah.
It's we good. Like it. What song are you going to play for us?
We're going to play
a song
play
us out.
Of mm-hmm. mine called Good Old American Values. And I feel like I should say something about it before we play
sure.
it. It's sort of weird to enter cold turkey.
Yeah.
it's a song I wrote
during the summer, the winter, excuse me, of 2016, during the Standing Rock protests. And I'm native, I'm Abenaki, which is native to the Northeast and the land that Dartmouth is on. That's why I went there. They have a nice scholarship for people like me.
As they should.
Yes, as they should. Yeah. So this song is situated in that that climate of colonialism and capitalism and all of the ways that they intersect.
This is Lula Wiles.
Can you pass me that bow? I'm just going to stay seated.
Nice.
Actually, no, I'm not, because this chair doesn't have arms. Can I switch with you, Ellie?
Yeah.
That was Lula Wiles, Issa Burke, Ellie Buckland, and Molly Obomsawin. This is All of It on WNYC. Thanks, ladies.
Thank you
for having us.
WNYC is supported by the Vital Projects Fund and the
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.